And welcome to the parents, coaches, and kids who play travel soccer around the United States. This is Shot Happens, your podcast about surviving travel and academy soccer. I am Robert Hay, at Robert Hay JR on Twitter. And joining me, as always, is the brains behind the podcast and the experience and the tech savvy and, well, pretty much everything else. I have to figure out what my role here is besides doing the opening. Reed Maltby, coach, how's it going over on your side of the microphone?
I'm dying over that intro. It's going really well, man. So the tech is really easy, I'm telling you, Mike. The website I use, it makes it real easy to take care of. The hardest part is just getting it syndicated to iTunes.
Yeah, podcasting is it seems to be something that's catching on. I guess it's something that normal people like us can do. So, I wanted to kick off the episode by giving a couple of updates to the listeners. We've been talking about a couple of different topics over the past few episodes, including some of the new practices in travel. And I wanted to just quickly, from my experience, give some feedback on a couple of these topics, including the more controversial ones. We are a few games into my daughter's team with the infamous build-out rule. And there have been no tears, no red cards, no arguments on the pitch. In fact, everything's gone fairly smoothly for a build-out play. Depending on your referee, it's been strictly enforced or it's been kind of enforced. But for the most part, everybody seems to be adapting to that rule change. And overall, the season has been going along well. I found out, Coach, and you maybe can comment on this. This might be a topic for an entire episode, but, I just, found out a couple weeks ago that the, scores that are being submitted to the league aren't being published. In fact, in my daughter's league, they aren't doing any scorekeeping at all publicly. So the standings are kind of empty right now and will be for the rest of the year. And that's kind of caused some angst amongst, some of the parents, but, we are adjusting to that. But overall, everybody seems to be adjusting to travel soccer, at least the general principle of it. So,
very cool. So let me ask you something, though. How are the kids taking the scores not being posted?
You know, as with kids, they know the score. I mean, when we walk off the pitch, it's like, we lost, so, you know, 6-1, or, you know, we drew this game or whatever. I mean, they know. They don't care if it's posted on a website. They know. We care because the league, there's two scores in our league. We do a game score and then we do a sportsmanship score, and the sportsmanship scores aren't even posted. And that's a big deal for some of us because they give out a trophy for sportsmanship at the end of the year. So we don't really know who's in the lead on the sportsmanship trophy. So it's a double whammy right there. But the kids know it. But they don't care if it's posted. The parents are more like, kind of would like to know that this counts, kind of thing.
That's so interesting. Yeah, the kids are like, oh, we lost 6-0 today. Can we get ice cream now?
Exactly.
What's exactly. Dinner?
When's practice again?
Yeah. What's really cool, though, I guess, is this is a psychological experiment, one, on how much the adult influence is on the game itself, because now you're seeing that scores and rankings don't really seem to matter to the kiddos, which is pretty interesting. So we'll see how many parents can keep from having like nervous breakdown during season. But two, what's really cool is not posting the sportsmanship scores means that everybody's sort of like has to be on their best behavior at all times because they don't know where they are in the rankings. You know, I once was working with a professional athlete. I won't say what sport, who he was. It's a he. And he had this charity, and I said, this is really good. I was helping him set up his sports camps. And I said, I was driving him back to the airport after one of his first camps. And I said, yeah, that's great, man. He says, yeah, I got this charity, and it's doing this. I said, that's great stuff, man. Good for you. And he goes, well, my agent said, I'm kind of a jerk in town, so I have to have this charity to up my image. So, like, wrong reason, but good underlying outcome. So it's sort of the same thing. It's like, you know, everybody's going to be fighting for that sportsmanship score, so maybe we're too competitive about this, but it's a good outcome.
Yeah, exactly. We get a trophy because we're the best sports, so we're gonna wave it around. I think we're kind of getting the point, but maybe not.
We're the best sports. We're the best sports. Na, 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 na.
You're at the award ceremony waving, you know, just getting up there high-fiving. Yeah, it's I don't know. It gets So if you are in a if you are in a league that doesn't that does sportsmanship stuff, give me your. I'd like to hear. I think we both like to hear your experience with it. So it's at Robert Hay JR on Twitter. Coach, give him what's the best way to reach you? Is it Twitter, or how do you want him to talk to you?
Probably Twitter. So at Coach _ Reed, and Reed's with two E's on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. If you send it to Coach _READ, then it's like reading Rainbow or something like that, I'm sure.
Oh, sweet. I'm in good company.
There you go. We'll have to check that one out. Well, let's get into the topic of the day. So I thought with the timing that is being recorded and what's going on, we talk a little bit about whether we should be playing soccer. And what I mean by that is, you know, when the fall season comes to an end, there's usually a lull in the travel season because of winter weather, at least in where I am. You know, I can't speak for all the podcast hosts who may have better weather over the winter than I do, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The snowstorm's coming. You know, where I am, we do have winter and snow and bad travel and things like that. But so soccer does kind of grind to a halt, but it shifts to futsal. And so there's a lot of discussions going on about what are the kids going to do? Are they going to play soccer? Are they going to stop? And I thought we'd kick off or play another sport, I should say, or play nothing at all. And I thought we'd kick this off by talking about the one of the real drivers over the past few years of this idea of all soccer all the time. And that's Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hour rule. And Coach, why don't you give you're well versed in this. I've read the book, but you've done videos on this and other things. Why don't you give the breakdown of the 10,000 hour rule?
I don't know if I'm well versed, but so Gladwell adapted because he's a pop psych writer. I mean, fantastic writer. I love his books, but he adapted research done by Erickson, I believe, not the Erickson that was child development, but one out of Florida, somewhere in Florida, that basically said that you could acquire skill if you worked at it for a minimum of 10,000 hours. You know, over a course of time, basically that was the threshold. At 10,000 hours, you were good enough at a particular skill. And so Gladwell used it in his book and actually adapted it to the 10,000 hour rule and said that it's, you know, deliberate practice. So practicing in ways that pushes your skill and sets it as much as possible. So if you reach 10,000 hours, you become good at a particular sport. Well, over the years, it's been debunked. Princeton came out with a study in like 2014 where they did a meta-analysis of 88 studies on deliberate practice. And what they found was that there was a huge variation based on domains. So, for instance, in closed domains where it's set skills and set activities and it's not a dynamic environment, yes, 10,000 hours might work. So, you know, violinists, for instance, because it's you know, you're based on your music and there's only so many strings and, you know, all the other variables are taken out of the picture, like weather conditions and things like that, right? So there is an opportunity. And if you look at the work done by Itzhak Perlman, or if you read the book by, actually a fantastic follow-up book on it would be Daniel Coyle's Talent Code.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can. But what Coyle found was in Itzhak Perlman's school, for instance, some kids would reach at 10,000 hours the ability to be really good at the violin. Other kids, it might take less. They maybe had some kind of propensity already to it. And some kids, 10,000 hours wasn't even close to enough for them. So there's still variations in it. But then if you get in really dynamic situations like a lot of sports, okay, games, practice, you know, accounts for only like there's a 26% difference based on these studies. But the idea is that because there's so many other dynamics going on that the ability to acquire the right skills to be adept at the game kind of go out the window. So everybody adapted it in the beginning because it's like, oh my gosh, all we have to do is put in 10. And I remember putting on my resume that I had coached for 10,000 hours to prove I was an expert. I can remember saying,
wow,
I've coached X kids for X thousand hours because the rule was still in effect and everybody still believed it. And so that's what we believe. And so what do? We make our kids train 3 or 4 times a week for a couple hours and then we take no off season. And like you said, 2 hours a day for 13 years, right? Our kids mm-hmm. are now all experts. Well, you and I both know doesn't happen anyway, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the big a big consequence of this, and I also read Matthew Syed's book about the same topic, which and it goes in a different direction, is it basically says there's no genius, there's no special, you're not special. You're just either in the right place at the right time and doing the work enough, or you're working hard and you have the right training if you go the Matthew Syed route. So it kind of takes away this idea of these people that we consider geniuses, Michelangelo, Beethoven, Lionel Messi. They're not special. They're just trained the right way or the right amount of time. And, you know, I think what appeals to parents about that is, hey, if I get my kid in the right club and they play soccer, since that's what this podcast is about, enough, then they will be good enough to reach the goal that we have set for them or they've set for themselves. And as you just said, it's been proven not to be true.
Yeah. Well, think about it this way. So there's research. So Johansson is the lead researcher, I think, on that Princeton study. And one of the things that she said is the same as, so was it Black Box? Was that Matthew Syed's book that talked about that?
I think it was. Yeah. I read it recently and I forgot the title.
brilliant work. I'm a big fan. So I think Franz Johansson has a book out called The Click Moment where it talks about it too. But it's the idea that it's deliberate practice, right? So, but there's got to be mastery built into it, because I could go out right now, grab a violin, grab the bow and just jam on that thing for 2 hours for the next 10 years and not even get close to being an expert, because I'm actually deliberately practicing towards mastery. I'm just picking up and playing on it, right? I'm just, you know, cats in the neighborhood are all caterwauling at me and dogs are howling and my kids are like, please stop doing that, because I'm not actually learning it. So that's the problem like you said, Itzhak Perlman's going to be able to crank out these experts because he's an expert. And so he's going to walk them through the process, right? And it's very deliberate and intentional. And it's about mastery. It's about mastering the techniques and it's about mastering the process, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is we put our kids in these activities and one, we have to hope that that coach that they're working with is a master teacher, really understands how to teach, because there's a difference between you teaching and your students learning. Just because you said it or showed it doesn't mean they acquired it, right? Mm-hmm. So we've got to have a master teacher who can actually transfer and convey, and it's got to be deliberate training, because getting our kids out there and just, you know, cruddy, sloppy practicing for 10,000 hours isn't going to make them a whole bunch of NLMSs. So I have to tell a funny joke, because I've been holding on to this all day. I wanted to do it in my live for Changing the Game project, but it didn't make sense. But it makes sense now when you started saying it, because you mentioned artists. Picasso's sitting in a cafe near the end of his career. And this woman walks up and she says, oh, Mr. Picasso, you're the greatest. I'm a huge fan. Would you please sketch me something? And he grabs a napkin and he quickly sketches out something on a napkin and he hands it to her. She goes, oh, thank you. I will cherish this forever. He says, that'll be $10,000. She goes, $10,000? It only took you 5 minutes to draw that. He says, no, it took me 40 years. That's the problem, right? It's even the masters that we look at and we look at the work, a lot of them weren't considered great artists until well beyond their years, right? Until they were off this earth. One, and two, it was at the very end of their lives that they became quote unquote masters, but they spent a lifetime as mentees under somebody, right? I mean, that was the whole lifestyle, was that somebody paid for them to be these artists, but then they trained under others. So there's your debunking of the 10,000 hour rule. Yes, if Lionel Messi took your kid under his wing and trained him deliberately and Lionel actually knew what he was doing as a coach, then maybe the 10,000 hours work.
Yeah. And that's maybe there's something to be said for the reason that, or for the fact that very few famous, well, athletes, for example, their kids are not as good as their father or mother is. So, there's probably, that's something to be said for that. So you talk about the idea of like, 40 years in the joke. Just a quick shout out to Chuck Klosterman. If you, check out his new book, But What If We're Wrong? He talks about that exact concept of the idea of what's popular now in 40 years probably won't be popular. And what will be popular is something that we don't even realize. So, we're talking a lot about books in this episode, but so I'll throw that one in there. We're giving everybody a lot of reading to do. But you got to do something at practice, right?
That keeps you from yelling things, right?
Exactly. It keeps you off the coach's back. It's my best reading time is practice. So, so we're talking about all these concepts, but you know, they have a very practical implication for our kids and the idea. So now that we don't need them to train 10,000 hours, we need them to train with the right people. It still brings up the question of, does that mean that they need to be playing soccer in this case nonstop? I mean, you know, you have a coach for your travel team in the spring and fall or spring all year, whatever it is. but that coach might be good, but they might not be able to teach your kid some of the skills that they need. So do they need to do supplemental training? You know, is there footwork training that needs to be done? Do they need to be more specialized? You know, depending on the age, you know, is it goalkeeper training, whatever. If you're like me and you live on the East Coast where it snows and soccer stops, do you put them in futsal? Because futsal is the, you know, the new hot thing for teaching footwork. I mean, is it still necessary, even though the idea of the 10,000 hours has been debunked, that our kids, if they want to be very good at the sport, still need to play it year-round and need to focus on that instead of other things?
So you caught me at a good time because I just returned from Prince Edward Island, where I was at the Prince Edward Island Physical Literacy Summit. And I told everybody in Canada, will you call your friends in the South and talk to them? Because they're doing something that's really cool. They've got overarching governing bodies regarding sport, and in every town and province and region is been governed by a provincial or regional group. So, for instance, sport is governed by Sport Canada, Sport PEI, Sport Prince Edward Island, and they actually have coaching tracks. So it doesn't matter what sport you coach, but there's Coach PEI, and the idea is that you get certified to up to like a level 4 coach. Just to be a coach, because it's not a matter of what sport, because it's, again, it's not about the hardware, it's about software. Can you actually coach? Can you be an educator? And so anyway, the whole conference, and they're also now pushing physical literacy heavily. Well, they've got one of the preeminent experts in the world on physical literacy, Dean Creolars, is up in Canada, and Dean was at the conference with us, and he did the morning keynote on Saturday morning, and absolute brilliance. And then, of course, we spent the weekend together chit-chatting, because here he is. He's a physical literacy person on just the activity side, and I'm a nut for that stuff on the sports side, so it was really cool to do the crossover talks. And what he was pointing out was, we're getting these kids that we've over-sported. Okay, I call it over-eliting, right? We over-elite these kids at young ages and make them specialized. And what we have is we have a bunch of physically illiterate people out there, because they're very good at a narrow bandwidth of skills. Hockey is big in Canada. They talk about it. You got a group of kids who are very good at hockey skills, but have no physical literacy whatsoever. What I mean by that is that there are foundational skills that we have to learn to be physically adept at moving in space, judging depth, proprioception, body awareness. All those things come into play. And in the beginning, when we were kids, we learned all that through play. But play has now been so over-elited and over-adultified that it's structured to the point where we're told exactly how to walk, how to run, how to step. And so the byproduct of that is that you've got kids that are physically incapable of playing other sports or of being athletic, quote-unquote, because they're just adept at certain narrow bandwidths of skills. And then the other side of that is the injuries. And you talk to Brett Fisher at the Fisher Institute, and you're seeing Tommy John surgery in 13-year-olds and ACLs blown in 10-year-olds. And these were injuries that happened to college age, or, you know, Tommy John used to happen 25 to 28. And now it's happening in 13-year-olds. Mm-hmm. So that's because the body structures are breaking down under this. They're factory workers. We're creating these little mini factory workers who are getting, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome because they're doing the same activity every single day, right? There's no variation. The idea of physical literacy is like any other kind of literacy. Before you can read, you have to understand letters, and then you understand hunks and chunks, and then you put small sentences together, and then you can read. You don't just take a kid and set Moby Dick in front of him, okay, or War and Peace, and say, we're going to work for 10,000 hours for the next 13 years until you learn to read this book, right? It's steps. So Dean says the same thing, and physical literacy is the ability of layering in based on the developmental models of the body and what kids are capable of learning and doing physically, layering it in until they're physically adept. And he gave the best example I could have ever heard for it. He said, imagine it's Legos, okay? And your concept is to give your kids a box full of Legos so they can use their imagination and be creative and build whatever the heck they want, right? Mm-hmm. But what we do when we specialize is we give our kids 3 Legos and say, build a masterpiece.
Good analogy.
I loved it. I said, Dean, I'm stealing it.
Interesting. Interesting. That is an interesting analogy. By the way, another book plug, Jeff Passan's The Arm Inside the $1 Billion Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports, talking about baseball injuries. That's a good resource for your 13-year-old Tommy John surgery stories. But I think that's kind of the reason why we're seeing a lot of knee injuries now, especially in girls in soccer, is the idea that of the specialization. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I am, again, not a doctor, as Napoon pointed out to us. But
You're not wrong. Dean pointed that out too. He says we always want to blame injuries. So we always want to segregate based on gender too. So we will blame injuries on gender, right? Oh, well, women get more knee injuries because of the Q angle and everything like that. He says, but here's the thing. If you look at the research, it's one-sided. They're typically, these injuries are occurring in just one side of the body. So he said, if it were just the Q angle is equal on both sides. So then girls would be blowing out both left and right, but they're typically blowing out one leg, the dominant leg, and it's because of overuse. So I tell you, look up Dean Creelar's, if you tweet at me, his last name is difficult to spell. It's a Dutch name. K-R-I-I-L-E-E-A-R-S. It's a hard name to spell, but he is an expert on it. He's got great presentations and he works with Cirque du Soleil. And here you are, you're one of the most stressful roles in the world. And obviously these athletes take an absolute pounding and even they are into physical literacy. They're experts at certain activities, are also considered experts in others too. So their tumblers are also very good at juggling and things like that because they wanted them to be physically literate. So they were adept and that helped them avoid injury and burnout, right?
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very interesting. So, okay. So we've discovered that playing soccer 365 days a year is probably not a good thing. But let's talk about, you know, when we were growing up, God, it sounds so old. When we were growing up, we would play multi-sport. Maybe I'm just speaking for myself. I was horrible at sports, but I played, you know, a couple of different sports. And most of everybody, I mean, how many sports did you play when you were, you know, in your early years, teen years?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So baseball, football, basketball, soccer, swimming.
Yeah.
Tennis. Mm-hmm. You name it. I mean, it's, yeah. We all did, right? And then you made games up. That's where the movie Basketball came from, is we would make games up in the vacant lot. Like, we're bored with this, so let's play football, but let's use a tennis ball and let's, mm-hmm. you know.
mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, there's some injuries whenever a tennis ball came into substitution. But, yeah, I mean, we would just play all kinds of sports and do all different kinds of things. But today, everything being structured the way it is, you know, everything is serious. Now, maybe I'm over exaggerating, but sports for kids is very serious. And even at the highest level, at the professional level, we hear a lot about the lack of international breaks that these top players are having and how that's impacting the club games and things like that. Is it better to just have a time where the kids aren't playing sports at all? Or is it better to just sit there and say, okay, you know, it's wintertime. Hey, there's a basketball team down there. Why don't you go play basketball? Why don't we sign you up for basketball? Or sign you up for, you know, badminton, or maybe not bad. That's a bad example, but, you know, something else, track, indoor track. Let's sign you up for this so that way you can be active. And we're replacing soccer with something else. So you're not having these repetitive injuries. You're not having this repetitive stuff, but you're actually still growing and developing physically and within a team structure.
It's much better, but you got to get the clubs on board because they're telling you that you have to do their activities. And then coaches are saying, if Johnny's not there this winter, it's going to affect Johnny's role on the team, right? And it's this, that, and the other. And then the parents get upset because there's this fear of missing out. I can't count the number of parents whose kids were under the age of 12, who stood, and I'm not kidding, I'm not exaggerating, panicked talking to me because they were so worried that Johnny or Susie was going to fall behind his or her peers. Like, your kid's 9. Your kid is not going to fall. Do they have recess at school? Do they have gym class? Your kid will not fall behind because she chose basketball instead of futsal in the winter. No, actually, some of my favorite athletes to coach were the multi-sporters because they had this athleticism, this proprioception, this intelligence that it's you only acquire when you're in different environments, right? So Wayne Gretzky credits his unbelievable ability to score goals to being in the right place at the right time. And he says that's because he was lacrosse and hockey. So he got to really understand where the puck or the ball was going, and he would go to where it was going to be. So there's this IQ that's there in these kids. And then the other piece with physical literacy that Dean Creelar's pointed out is it's three-pronged. It's competence, which is the ability to do physical movements right. You know, it's that confidence in your movement patterns. And confidence, which is a psychological construct, your confidence in your ability to do those physical movements. So it's the ability to do them and your belief in yourself. And then it's motivation, the excitement to want to do them, right? Mm-hmm. So what we get when we have kids that are strictly specialized is they know how many specialized athletes, you know, who can't walk and chew gum, but man, can they play X sport, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they know that. So they actually lack confidence because they know what they are physically capable and incapable of doing based on the fact that they look around and think, I'm missing this skill. When I was in graduate school, it was a jock school. It was sports psych, sport performance and behavior. So it was all of us former athletes in this master's program together, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we had hockey stars and track. We had one of the top skaters in the world in our class. Top skaters in the world. She was a synchronized skater, one of the top teams in the world, won 3 national championships and had gone to Worlds twice with her team. This gal, she could skate the lights out. All of them could on that team, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put her on our softball team. She's like, man, we're going to build the best softball team ever and go beat all the undergrads into submission because we got a bunch of NCAA champions and stuff on our team, right? She couldn't throw a ball more than 10 feet. I mean, it was bad. And we teased her, and she's like, all I've ever done is skate. This is a person that could land a triple sal cow and everything else, but had no confidence in any other physical skills because she'd never done any other sport.
Wow. Interesting. So it sounds like actually, so instead of taking off time, it's probably better to actually put into another sport or another couple sports and just build up that physical memory or that body memory and that mental capacity to translate skills.
Yeah, but you know, if you talk to like Fisher and Stephen Boyle and Brian Grasso, and you talk to Raymond Verheen and some of the great ones out there that talk about movement and anyway, if you talk to them, what you find out is that rest is an important part of it, right? So your body does need rest and recovery. That's actually, you know, that's when your body actually rebuilds and repairs itself. So when you give it rest, so rest is vital for kids, and I do advocate it. Now, I also advocate other activities because there are those domains you have to cover: the social, the psychological, the spiritual, the intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm missing some off the top of my head, but. Put them in, if they're not in sport, put them in activities that are building those other things. Put them in chess club. That's building the intellectual and probably the social, because there's got to be some social interaction in there, right? And it's, you know, I talked with Jerry Lynch the other day, and he said, you know, the spiritual is huge too. Kids need to have those spiritual abilities built in, that whole mindfulness and mm-hmm. you know, understanding your why and everything. So, yeah, I don't think they should sport year round. I think they should have some rest, and rest could be a completely different activity that has nothing to do with the physical aspect, but maybe one of the other domains that our kids need to be successful.
So it sounds like it's your fault for this this whole idea of specialization, you as the club director, because you're the one I'm picking on you. But from a club perspective, I mean, is it about dollars and cents? I mean, let's be crass here. I mean, obviously some of these guys or gals who are running these clubs are probably sitting there saying, yeah, you know, they still believe in the 10,000 hour rule. And it's like, these kids just need to practice soccer nonstop. But is part of it a dollars and cents thing too, where it's like, we've got to fill, you know, our specialty class, we've got to fill our futsal league, we've got to fill, you know, our winter soccer league. And, you know, if we push this on these kids, you know, and play to these parents' insecurities, I mean, at all ages, you, as a parent, you're insecure about your kid's place. They could be the best player on, you know, the best team in the club, but you're still worried about that kid transferring from California next year who's going to take that spot, and then you lose that college scholarship, or, you know, all the way down to the line to that last kid picked for, you know, the travel team, where it's like, I'm one better kid away, or the, you know, my kid is one better kid away from not playing. So it seems like, I'm asking a very long question, it's turning into a statement, it seems like this is clubs playing on parents' insecurities on the negative side. And to be positive, in a lot of cases, it's these administrators don't know better. They just sit there and think, this is what you should be doing because this is how you get better. Like, is it in between that, or is it just, I mean, is it hitting one of those two extremes?
You know, it's funny. I really want to write a book called like The Greatest Lie Ever Told, or The Great American Con. And this is it, is youth sports, because it's being driven by the beverage companies and equipment companies and the technology companies, and it's a $15 billion industry. And then you see what happens with basketball and the FBI and recruiting at young ages. And so it's being driven by these entities that are way above where we are in youth sports, but they're driving the industry, right? And then what happens is now you've got parents who are flipping out because it comes down to the error that we make as adults, ERR, right? We do these things out of ego, revenue, or resume, right? So clubs are, coaches are doing what they do out because they're stoking their ego, they're stroking their ego, right? They're building their resume or they're making money, right? Mm-hmm. And clubs are doing it that way. And parents are looking at it that way too. Parents are living vicariously through their kids, which is building their ego, right? Parents are bragging on Facebook about their kids and building up their quote unquote resume based on their kids, and they're building up their kids' resume so they look good for colleges. And then it comes down to revenue. They're doing this because they're told they're going to get a scholarship. So you've got parents pushing back on clubs saying that we need this. You've got clubs pushing back saying, looking up above them and saying, yeah, this is what we've got to do. And you've got misguided people who are misunderstanding the whole industry because they're not, it's because there's this big con that's being played, right? Mm-hmm. And what you also have, because I've seen it, I've seen the books for clubs before where they had, you know, they were making $4 or $5 million a year and they got to the end of the year and there's no money left. And you'd go, where's all the money? Well, we have an executive director who's paid X, and we have a tournament director who's paid X, and we have 10 DOCs, and we have 6 assistant DOCs, and we make promises because we're so afraid this coach who's so good is going to go to this other club that what we told them is that we can give them a stipend of X, but we'll make them a guaranteed $30,000 a year based on the fact that we'll do camps and off-season training and everything like that, and they'll get extra money for doing all of that. And so you've got these people in the organization who it's their livelihood. I was there. I was once a director of coaching who was told this is the stipend you get. The rest of your money is made from the number of teams you coach, and you can make extra when you work camps and do winter training. So me being needing to put bread on the table, what I do? I push the winter training and push the camps, right? Like crazy. And it's like my argument always was, not from that side, was how can I be a director of coaching and manage all my coaches and make sure they are capable of doing what they do and everything like that, if I'm coaching 5 teams?
Yeah, really.
I'm invisible. You know, everybody's going, who's our director of coaching? Oh, he's over there. 3 hours a night, 5 nights a week. So there's the problem is you've got these 3 entities all playing this con on each other. You got big business, okay, the upper echelon. You've got clubs and coaches and everybody. And then you've got these parents that are like, this is the way to go. And it's just, you know, it's created this situation where we really feel, and rightly so, because I've seen it, that if our kid doesn't play year round, then we don't just acquiesce to the nickel and diming and specialize, that my kid's going to get cheated out. Because why? Because we cut kids now under age 12. Which, again, everybody at the top of the pyramid is complaining because there's no talent pool. Well, that's because you cut them all when they were 8 years old. 9 years old, 10 years old, they finally just gave up and went and found something else. Oh yeah, video games where the adults aren't involved at all. Sorry, adults, no adults, I'm going to play video games.
Yeah, that's how I feel sometimes when I play video games. Well, and you know, this comes back to the beginning too. So you have this, you as a coach, your director of coaching, you're coaching 5 teams. And when you're coaching that many teams, just the fact that there's only so many hours in the day that you have, you aren't focusing probably on these teams. You're pulled in so many different directions. These are probably teams of different ages, different types, different whatevers, that you're going from team to team to team, bouncing back and forth, dealing with all the issues, and you're pushing off all these camps and all these other things that you're doing. That's taking away from your time to really understand the players, work with them, and the substitution is you're pushing them off on another camp. And so it seems to create this sick cycle of the only way to get the attention of your coach is to go to his or her next camp. And that seems really cynical, but I mean, that's kind of what I'm hearing from you in the obviously not in every situation, but I mean, we're creating a world of youth travel soccer where it's like the gold is just over the hill. And the coach is pushing you to say, just keep climbing, and you'll get there. And it's every time you reach a new plateau, just keep climbing kind of thing, but not in a positive way.
No, it is. And I was guilty of it. And I can remember, the only difference between me and a walker from Walking Dead when I was coaching in the thick of it in the middle of my career was that I had good gear. Our club had good swag, so I dressed better than walking. Right? But that's what it was. You know, you get to the 10th week of season and you stumble out of the car for the 950th time and you stumble on the field and you run through a few things and then you stumble back to your car, you go home and wash, rinse, and repeat, right? And then it's like, oh, it's camp season now. Oh, even more fun. So it was. And it, for me, it was a livelihood. It was the only way I was going to make a living. And, you know, for these clubs, it's revenue streams and there's this fear of losing out. I mean, there is a very distinct, cause I had it. There was a very distinct fear. I always let my kids play other sports, my athletes, my players. But there was always this fear that they would go to that other sport and I'd maybe never see them again. Mm-hmm. You know? So it's real.
Yeah.
And then as a parent, there is that fear, like you said, am I putting my kid in front of the coach enough to be recognized so that my kid doesn't get cut when 150 show up and they only keep 10?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not to be unfair to you, the coach, because like you said, this is a livelihood and this is the structure that we're in. You know, you're a teacher and like any other kind of teacher, it's just your contribution isn't valued. So you don't have that hefty salary that comes down just from being, you know, good at what you do. It's, you know, you have to create a livelihood for yourself. So in a lot of ways, for many coaches, this is just a situation that it is what it is and you have to pay your own bills, you know, so you're in the same boat as the parents in a lot of ways. So where does the change come from? Again, we're bringing this at a very high level and we'll bring it down, but where does this change come from? Is this parents sitting there educating themselves and saying, coach, it's great. We'll see you in the spring. You know, my kid's going to go run indoor track for a couple of months. And when she comes back, she's going to be, you know, running even faster, but it just won't be with soccer ball.
So there are two suggestions, and of course they're humble because they're coming from me. It's not like, you know, but one is you've got U.S. soccer sitting on $100 million, right? And the big question is, what are you going to do about it? And where we typically have invested our money in sports is in the upper echelons, right? So we build more DAs and we bring in, you know, let's add another expansion team to this league and it's all about the upper echelon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if we funneled that money into the grassroots so that all of our population could afford to play sports and so that we were giving that opportunity, our field is going to be bigger, right? And iron sharpens iron. So the more kids that are playing, the more that are playing against each other and we're helping make each other better. The other piece of that is funnel that money into the lowest echelon for coaching. Give the resources, give the opportunity to learn and be educated to be good professionals to our coaches at the lower levels. Because what's happening is we're vastly ignoring our new coaches and our recreation coaches and our lower level coaches. And they're only doing what they either know from what they were told, which is, again, if we're still doing what we were doing 50 years ago, we're doing something wrong. You know, the world evolves, my friend. Engineers, computer engineers are not doing what we did 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Cardiologists are not doing what we did 50 years ago, but that's all they know because that's all they see in the movies, and that's how they were taught and everything, and we don't give them the resources. Give them the resources for the software. Let's start focusing on educating coaches at the youngest ages and at the lower levels on ethics and on movement patterns, physical literacy, and on child development skills and learning environments. And, you know, when I throw out words like Vygotsky and Erickson and Piaget to people, I get blank stares. And like, you know, you say that in educator circle, they all nod their heads.
Oh, yeah.
We're educators. Our job is we're shaping behaviors, right? The outcomes are the byproduct of the behaviors that we're creating in kids, and we're trying to create learning environments where they can learn more effectively. If you had people like that, so well, and here's how I know, because I've been around those people, and by the end of my career, hopefully I was one, so well versed in the software of developing people and athletes that they needed less time to create better products, right? Mm-hmm. So, in other words, give our grassroots coaches PhDs in coaching. Instead of investing that money in the upper echelons, build from the base up. The second piece of the puzzle goes back to that whole coaching thing, is we have got to, as a nation, across all youth sports, standardize what matters, how we train them, how we evaluate them. Because right now, and this was my live on Facebook for Change the Game Today, right now, what gets measured gets managed. And right now, what we're measuring is not what matters. Chris Snyder at U.S. Olympic Committee, he works with the coaches, and USOC just put out, it's coming out, a document called the Quality Coaching Document. It's absolutely brilliant because it looks at all the domains equally across the board, equally. And this is what Nick Levitt from the FA told me last night when I was on a call with him. The FA is way ahead of us because I harangued sports organizations for not following the science, pseudoscience, and teaching only the hardware and not focusing on the software. He goes, nope, we're focusing on software reading. He goes, if you do 3 hours of this, you do 3 hours of psychology, you do 3 hours of child development, you do 3 hours of this. I'm like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? He goes, no. I said, the FA, can they please call other countries and tell them this? I mean, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. It's equal across the board, right? So USOC is coming out with this document that's saying this is what quality coaching means, right? Because remember, we go back to the 10,000 hour rule. If you have somebody like Itzhak Perlman, who's not only brilliant, but also a great educator, mm-hmm. teaching you to play the violin, you've got a shot at it, right? We need mm-hmm. a bunch of Itzhak Perlmans out there teaching all of our kids when it comes to sports, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's quality coaching. It's physical literacy. It's all the pieces I said. So Chris Snyder at USOC says we have to stop measuring outcomes. We talk about how many games we won, how many strikes, how many goals, how many this, how many that, and that's how clubs promote it. We got this many kids with scholarships, and we got this many kids on the national team, and we play in this league, and we won this many tournaments. It's all outcomes, and the coaches who win the most games are the ones who promoted to work with the best teams and all that other pieces, right? Chris said, if that's the case at the USOC, then I should walk up to a coach and say, how do you value your ability as a coach? How do you judge? How do you evaluate? And most coaches say, we won a gold medal. Okay. So when we go to the Olympics next time, if you don't win gold, then you're a crappy coach now, right? No, I'm still a good coach. But you just said you evaluate how good you are based on winning medals. Well, no, that's not what I meant. There's your answer. So we need as a nation to start to create a model where we are educating coaches, no matter what sport they play, in a professional way, like we would engineers and doctors and everybody else, right? And better evaluation of what it means to be a quality coach, because it has nothing to do with the hardware, with the outcomes. It has everything to do with the soft skills.
Hmm. Well, I wouldn't let parents off the hook here, because I think that going back to an earlier episode, you know, parents are supposed to be doing their research, and they're supposed to be comparing clubs, and they're supposed to be, you know, comparing different systems here. And you're right. You know, U.S. soccer could be doing a lot more. There should be more coaching education. Again, as someone who is I am F licensed, you know, for what that's worth. But I would benefit as a soccer coach so much, a rec soccer coach so much, from standardized training, which, by the way, my club is providing. But we as parents shouldn't be off the hook as this as well, because we should be demanding from our clubs, you know, this is what I don't want my kids' coaches, you know, to be treated this way, or I don't want them to act this way to me. I don't want to be, you know, marketed to in a certain way, because if I don't feel like my kid is learning for what they are putting in and what I am putting in, there are other clubs that may be valuing my money just as much. So I think we as parents should have a say in this, and be able to step up and talk to our club administrators and talk to our coaches and say, you know, my kid is enjoying this. You know, we're going to play futsal in the winter because my kid just really wants to do something different, but at the same time, stick with soccer. Or, you know, that camp sounds great, but my kid really has wanted to play football for, you know, a few years now, and we just want to give him time to play some football, and we'll be back in the next season, you know, a better athlete because of it. So I think parents as well, we need to be able to resist this marketing, but at the same time, turn it around on our club and our coaches and say, understood where you're coming from, but this isn't for me right now. We'll be back in the next season after we spend some time in the swimming pool and, you know, learn water polo or you know, the butterfly or something like that. So awesome. I think it's on all of us. It truly is on all of us.
It is. And I would agree. And there are some organizations out there who've been using the rhetoric of TikTok. You know, it's like we say return the experience to the children. In other words, we think that the adults need to be involved, mm-hmm. but we need to put the children at the center, right? It's player-centered. It's child-centered, right? Mm-hmm. But there are some groups out there that are like, parents, you need to rise up against sports organizations, against soccer clubs, and take the game back. No, we don't need the animosity between the groups. We need to work together to find a solution. And you're right. Parents, you're the customers. And it's funny because I actually got into a heated argument one time with a leader of a club who said, they're not my customers. I said, where's your paycheck coming from, man? Because mine comes from them. You know, you're the customers. And as the customers, you don't have a full say, right? So mm-hmm. P&G doesn't P&G is one of the greatest consumer goods companies in the world. They listen to their customers. Now, they don't just go out and do exactly what their customers say, but they certainly understand what their customers want and need, and they create products centered around that. Well, that's what we, as customers, we should be pushing back in a professional way of this is what we like to see. How do you evaluate your clubs, right? Parents, I mean, it's if you're educated and know what you want, then you should be pushing back and saying, I want this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see how you're absolutely right. Just because you ask for something doesn't mean you're going, you should get it or you're going to get it. But how do they respond? Do they listen? Do they give you this opportunity to talk? Is there, you know, can you call the administrator and say, can we schedule time to chat? Or, you know, do they have parent listening sessions or things like that? I think those are valuable things to look for at the beginning when you're shopping for a club. So you don't get too late into the process and then go, I'm tired of this. My kid's tired of this. And you drop out entirely when maybe it's just a matter of as a bad fit from the beginning. You didn't look into it.
Yeah. And you lose money and you get a black mark because clubs talk to each other and then they call you a club bouncer and everything like that. And then you get this negative mark. Cause I used to get the phone calls or emails. They're like, well, watch out for someone. So they're club bouncers. And then I sat down and talked to them and found out why, you know? So it's interesting because my daughter recently took a babysitting job out here and family had her come out and visit them. First it was a phone interview, then come and visit and talk with the parents and she got grilled. Then they wanted to see a resume. Then they wanted a list of references relevant to babysitting. They wanted to make sure she was background checked, all that. Then they had her come out and work with the kids supervised so that they could see how she worked with the children. And then she finds out that they are going to be in the house at all times, mostly in the same room while she babysat because they just moved and put together a bunch of furniture and all like that. And they just wanted somebody to be with the kids, but they're going to be in the room. And I'm like, you jump through that many hoops with them going to be sitting in the room with you? She goes, yeah. And I said, dang, we got it all wrong. Cause in the sports world, we go, anybody want to coach this team? You got it. You're the sucker that raised his hand.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, as parents, you got to look at it that way. I mean, you wouldn't choose your doctor based on the number of vaccinations he completed last year, but you'll choose a club based on the number of tournaments they won. Really? I mean, you choose the doctor on a whole bunch of other intangibles, right? Mm-hmm. So be a little bit more thorough about deciding on what clubs you want to be at.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It all comes back to that first episode where we talk about doing your research, doing your homework, and know what you're getting yourself into. And if you don't do that, you're going to set yourself up for failure from the beginning. So, all right. Well, coach, any other tips or advice, any other sports you'd recommend these young soccer players go into?
Oh my gosh. Any sport. I mean, it's honestly,
do you know what sport I find translates really well, both as a coach and as a player? Basketball. Basketball translates really well.
Yeah.
Basketball, I use basketball hockey drills with my rec team. Sometimes there's a ball reaction drill that I've used with, well, I use with my 8U team, and it was the exact same drill. I high school and college teams that I saw used, and it's the same skill. So.
Then
you said
hockey, because it's a different surface. It's a dynamic surface. The cool thing is you're training different pathways in the brain, so you're expanding the brain paths, you know, and neurophysiologically, you're growing your kids when you put them in these activities. Swimming, any water sports are great. So a really cool analogy that John got from somebody, I don't remember who he said it, but here's a thought to think about parents when it comes to specialization. If you choose for your child, or I get a lot of parents that, well, my kid only wants to play one sport. And I totally get that, but my son only wants to eat carnival food if it's deep fried and on a stick. But you know, every once in a while, I got to jam a piece of broccoli down his throat just to make sure he's growing, right? Same thing. You've got to have these with your kids. You just have to have these non-negotiables that, yes, I get you want to play this sport, but we do want to see you meet those domain activities, right? And so it was put this way. If you look at our landscape right now with all of our kids specializing at such a young age, if you were going to train a bunch of kids on, for instance, water polo or something like that, what would be the very first thing you'd do with a group of young kids the day they show up at water polo practice? You'd make sure they know how to swim, right?
I would hope
so. And yet, how many of our kids don't even know how to run properly because we just throw them right into specialization? So we're not even paying attention to the domain they're in, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I always advocate for parents to get their kids in all these activities that do require them to learn at the base these skills, because it's building these learning pathways in the brain.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm glad that my kids diversify their sports in some way too. So, makes me feel a little bit better about that. Well, I think this topic has been well combed. I'm sure we, although I'm actually probably wrong on that. I'd like to hear some other feedback. So we've given out our Twitter names again. It's for me, it's at Robert Hay Jr. You can come at me for my naive opinion on these things. And then Coach is at Coach_Reed. You praise him for his advanced thought and his experience.
I was going to say for my completely false statements. Right? That's a specious argument.
The nice thing about what we do here is we make this universal as much as we can. And, you know, something that's not at a high level where, you know, this only is of interest to if your kid is, you know, a future Olympic athlete or is going to be signed by, you know, NWSL or MLS. This is something that, you know, millions and millions of kids are going through every year. So, and, you know, you parents, this is something that you're experiencing. So, so this has been another episode of Shot Happens. Thank you to Soccer Nation for supporting us, for distributing and putting out the show and putting in a good word for us amongst their wonderful readers and listeners. Coach, thank you again for your insight and thoughts. And, I'll turn it over to you to put a bow on this episode.
Hey, Shot Happens, but it doesn't have to ruin all the fun, right?